600, Unit 7, Modern Georgia. The decades following World War II saw the emergence of modern Georgia. This was a time of major growth and change, but there were many growing pains along the way. African Americans led a movement to end the segregation, discrimination, and disfranchisement under which they lived. The nonviolent movement was met with massive resistance. However, supported by Supreme Court decisions, federal laws, sympathetic whites, and the determination of the African American community, the civil rights movement began to dismantle the barriers preventing full citizenship. Georgia government and politics also underwent a major change. Several Georgia governors began significant reforms, from civil rights to more government efficiency to education. Georgia was once a stronghold of the Democratic Party. In the years after World War II, Georgia became a state with two major political parties, the Republicans and the Democrats. Georgia's economy continued its transformation. Agriculture became increasingly diverse, new manufacturing emerged, and the service industry became an important economic sector. Transportation by land, air, and sea spurred economic growth. Urbanization proceeded at an increasingly rapid pace, and the state's population grew in racial, ethnic, and religious diversity. Problems of poverty, pollution, and other effects of growth brought challenges. Georgia also offered increasing opportunities for quality education, for the developments of artistic, scientific, and cultural organizations, and for recreation. Many nationally and internationally known figures in these fields were Georgia-born and raised. This period saw the final transformation of our state to the Georgia we know today. Page 602 contains a focus on the reading skill, summarizing. Page 603 contains signs of the times about fads and fashion, population, science and inventions, literature, transportation. Page 604, Chapter 24, The Civil Rights Movement in Modern Georgia. Chapter Preview, Terms. Integration, Minimum Foundation Program for Education, Brown versus Board of Education, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Sit-In, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Civil Rights Act of 1964, Voting Rights Act. People: Harry S. Truman, James Neybritt Jr., Marvin Griffin, Ernest Vandiver, Jacob Rothschild, John Sibley, Hamilton Holmes, Charlene Hunter, Rosa Parks, William B. Hartsfield, Martin Luther King Jr., Ralph David Abernathy, Andrew Young, Benjamin Mays, Julian Bond, John Lewis, Leroy Johnson, Ivan Allen Jr., Carl Sanders, Jimmy Carter, Maynard Jackson. Places: Montgomery, Greensboro, Albany, Americus, Birmingham, Washington, Selma. As the United States entered World War II, African American poet Langston Hughes had predicted that the war would change American race relations. Pearl Harbor put Jim Crow on the run. That crow can't fight for democracy and be the same old crow he used to be. Hughes was disappointed that the war seemed to bring little change to American race relations in spite of the courageous service by African Americans. Sometimes, however, when historians study a period in the past, they can see that small changes began to happen that would lead to major changes. African American men and women made contributions to the war effort, and many were no longer willing to settle for second-class status. Some whites feared new demands for equality, and they came home from the war just as determined to maintain white supremacy. Other changes to both politics and the economy impacted race relations. Progressive Southern whites began to realize that their Jim Crow institutions prevented the area from modernizing. They became more racially moderate. While other African Americans were often willing to work with moderate whites for a gradual change, many young African Americans thought they had waited long enough. By the late 1950s and 1960s, liberal whites agreed. The country was on the verge of a revolution in the relationship between the races. The reform in civil rights came from both the government and the people. The courts made major decisions that struck down segregation laws and disfranchisement methods. Presidents and Congress supported new laws to guarantee equality and voting rights. African Americans and supportive whites worked for decades in nonviolent ways to bring about an end to the old system of the South. Georgia was at the center of this movement. Page 606, Section 1, The Presidents, the Courts, and Civil Rights. As you read, look for key people in the civil rights movement, notable events in the civil rights movement, important legislation, terms, integration, minimum foundation program for education, Brown versus Board of Education. Some of the work for civil rights came from the national government. President Truman began the march toward reform with two executive orders. President Eisenhower used troops to protect African American students who desegregated Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. President Lyndon Johnson supported two major civil rights bills in Congress. The Federal District Court and the U.S. Supreme Court handed down major decisions reversing decades of discrimination laws. Although enforcement of these changes was not always what it needed to be, by 1970, the legal structure for a more integrated society was in place. Harry Truman and Civil Rights. Although the New Deal had helped African Americans with jobs and other programs, there were no specific laws to protect civil rights. During the presidency of Harry Truman, things began to change. Truman had a reputation for fighting the KKK in his home state of Missouri. After the war, Truman established the Committee on Civil Rights to report on the conditions of African Americans and make recommendations for changes. While getting a Civil Rights Act through Congress did not seem possible, Truman did what he could as president, as commander-in-chief, and as the head of the executive branch of government. In 1948, he issued orders to desegregate the armed forces and the executive departments of the national government. Both of these acts were important in the growing call for a more equal and just society. The desegregation of the armed forces had a major impact in the South. All of the military bases in the South would now be islands of integration in the surrounding sea of segregation. Integration is the bringing of people of different racial or ethnic groups into society or an organization as equals. Because Georgia had so many military installations, it was strongly affected by this change. Soldiers who worked and lived together while on base could not have a meal together or go to a movie in a southern town. By this time, the Democratic Party was becoming more and more divided. At the national level, the party had embraced Roosevelt's New Deal with the increases in power it brought to the federal government. During the Democratic Convention in 1948, against the objections of Southern Democrats, the party called for full civil rights for African Americans. Many Southern whites were so opposed that they left the Democratic Party. They formed the Southern Rights Party, whose members were nicknamed Dixiecrats. In the 1948 presidential election, Georgia's electoral votes went to Truman. Truman failed to get any civil rights legislation through Congress. However, during his presidency, the courts made decisions more favorable to civil rights. The landmark decision came during the presidency of Dwight D. Eisenhower. Brown versus Board of Education. Since its founding in 1909, the NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, had been challenging discrimination and segregation in the courts. The Supreme Court had said that some actions of the states and local communities violated the constitutional rights of African American citizens. In 1915, the court found that grandfather clauses, which prevented African Americans from voting, violated the 15th Amendment to the Constitution. Yet even without grandfather clauses, white primaries and literacy tests kept most African Americans from voting. In 1917, the Supreme Court ruled that city and state governments could not pass laws that set up separate housing zones for blacks and for whites. That had not stopped segregated neighborhoods. Whites simply did not sell their homes to African Americans. In the 1930s and 1940s, the NAACP began to have some important court successes. However, it sometimes took years for those decisions to be enforced by state and local law enforcement officials who supported segregation. In 1944, the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Smith v. Allwright said that African Americans could participate in primary elections. In the 1946 King v. Chapman case, the U.S. Court of Appeals upheld the ruling that the white primary was unconstitutional. This decision led to more African Americans voting, which in turn gave them more political influence with whites who were trying to get elected to office. The NAACP also began to target educational inequalities, first at the level of law schools and graduate schools. NAACP lawyers could easily prove that there were no facilities for those types of schools for African Americans. The courts basically said that if the state could not provide equal facilities in the state, they would have to admit African Americans to the whites-only institutions. This led to many moves in the South and other places where segregation was practiced to improve schools for African Americans. In Georgia in 1949, Governor Herman Talmadge established the Minimum Foundation Program for Education to put more money into schools. In 1951, a 3% sales tax was enacted to fund it. To improve their quality, black schools got more money than white schools. Talmadge and others wanted to make sure they did not have to admit blacks to whites-only schools. Talmadge also began preparing the way to actually shut down the very school system he was building up. He supported an amendment to the state constitution that would allow the public school system to close down rather than have black and white children attend school together. The Supreme Court decisions on higher education were important, but the bigger goal was to broaden education at the lower levels. That would affect many more people. In the 1950s, several cases of parents against public schools in their communities made their way from lower courts to the U.S. Supreme Court. Five were brought together under the case Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. NAACP attorney Thurgood Marshall was assisted by Atlanta-born attorney James Neybrot, Jr., a graduate of Morehouse College. The Brown case was based on the important argument that black children were getting an unequal education. It was easy to show that funding for the students was unequal, that teacher pay was different, and that school buildings, classroom, and textbooks were inferior. The case, however, went further. The NAACP brought in research that showed that segregation had a negative impact on the psychological and social well-being of children. The NAACP tried to show that simply improving the physical aspects of schools and equalizing funding would not be enough. In their 1954 unanimous decision in the Brown v. Board of Education case, the nine justices on the Supreme Court did away with the separate but equal doctrine that had been in effect since the 1896 Plessy v. Ferguson decision. The court said that separate was inherently unequal, that the very act of requiring separation made African Americans unequal. The 14th Amendment guaranteed equality under the law and specifically said that states could not deny rights the national government gave citizens. Inequality in states was, therefore, unconstitutional. In 1955, the court, in a decision known as Brown II, told the nation's schools to end segregation in schools with all deliberate speed. White response, massive resistance, acceptance, and support. The reaction in Georgia and other southern states was swift and hostile. In 1953, Even before the Supreme Court decision, the Georgia legislature passed a constitutional amendment that allowed the state to close down the public school system. Private schools would be able to remain segregated, and the government would give parents tuition vouchers for them. The public ratified the amendment in November 1954, but the vote was close. In 1956, white Southern members of the U.S. Senate and House wrote the Southern Manifesto, attacking the Brown decision as being unconstitutional and an attack on the rights of the states. Throughout the South, white opponents of the decision, including the Georgia legislature, called for the impeachment of Chief Justice Earl Warren and members of the Supreme Court. White politicians called for protection of white supremacy, states' rights, and the Southern way of life. In another show of defiance, the state legislature also passed a law changing the Georgia state flag in February 1956. The head of the state Democratic Party had suggested the idea in 1955, and two state senators proposed the legislation. According to the Georgia Constitution, the state flag design was decided by the legislature. The public had no vote on it. Much of the new state flag was the Confederate battle flag, called the St. Andrew's Cross. The left-hand part of the flag was the state seal on a vertical blue background. State Representative Denmark Groover stated at the time that it would show that we in Georgia intend to uphold what we stood for. The flag became increasingly controversial in the 1990s, and African Americans and business leaders wanted to change it. Shortly before he died in 2001, Groover returned to the House chambers to admit that opposition to desegregation had been the motivation for the flag change. He called for the legislature to adopt a new flag to end this cauldron of discord. In spite of efforts under Governor Zell Miller to change the flag, it took the effort of his successor, Governor Roy Barnes, to get a different flag. The current Georgia flag became official in 2004 when the voters chose its design over the Barnes flag. In 1957, the first major effort at school desegregation at Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas, had not gone well. There, nine African-American students braved threats, shouts, and spitting as they made their way into the all-white high school. President Eisenhower used National Guard troops to protect the students for the entire school year. In Georgia, events moved more slowly. The governors, beginning with Herman Talmadge, threatened to close the schools rather than allow them to integrate. Both Governor Marvin Griffin, elected in 1954, and his successor, Ernest Vandiver, insisted that no blacks would attend school with whites in the state of Georgia. The legislature passed laws to try to make sure desegregation never occurred. One law said that the Brown decision was void in the state of Georgia. The state's leaders tried to justify these actions on the basis of states' rights. Fear by white extremists of losing white supremacy also led to the refounding of the KKK in 1955. The next year, several thousand Klan members gathered at Stone Mountain to burn a cross. Over the next few years, members of the KKK were involved in violence and even murder as they tried to stop any civil rights progress. Most whites were not that extreme, but they did fear a major change in their way of life. They had been raised in a Jim Crow system and just thought it was the natural order of things. Many believed that it was what God intended. Some whites feared that blacks would compete for their factory jobs. A few whites actually spoke out in favor of civil rights. Many were religious leaders. One was Rabbi Jacob Rothschild of the Hebrew Benevolent Congregation in Atlanta. As early as 1947, the rabbi had taken a stand against the segregation of African Americans. In October 1958, the congregation's support for civil rights led to the bombing of its temple. While the sanctuary was not hit, other parts of the structure suffered over $100,000 in damages. Both the mayor and the editor of the Atlanta Constitution, Ralph McGill, quickly condemned the action. Both blamed not only the extremists who carried out the action, but Southern politicians who encouraged citizens to defy the law. The desegregation of Atlanta schools. In 1959, a federal court ordered Atlanta to desegregate its public schools. Fearful that the legislature might close the schools, mothers, mainly white, formed an organization called HOPE, Help Our Public Education. Other Georgia cities also established chapters. The group strongly believed that closing public schools was wrong. Atlanta business leaders, however, had an economic concern. They were afraid that closing the schools was such open defiance of the Supreme Court that it would hurt the city's image and interfere with their efforts to bring northern businesses and investors to the city. They were supported by Atlanta Mayor William Hartsfield. The legislature created a special commission to determine what to do. In 1960, Governor Vandiver appointed Atlanta attorney and banker John Sibley to chair the group, which became known as the Sibley Commission. Meeting in every congressional district in the state, the commission listened as Georgians voiced their opinions about how the state should respond. Although about 200 African Americans did come forward, most speakers were white. The majority of those wanted to close the schools. In the end, with many urban leaders opposed to school closure and many white citizens in favor, the Sibley Commission recommended that the choice of closing the schools or integrating them be left up to the local school boards. In 1961, Atlanta desegregated its schools with no incidents. In other places, desegregation took longer. In Augusta, the Board of Education's failure to act led to a lawsuit known as the Acri case. There, the court eventually hired outside experts to design a plan of more than token desegregation. The desegregation of the University of Georgia. The NAACP also wanted to integrate Georgia's public institutions of higher education. They looked for talented African Americans who met the admission standards. Hamilton Holmes was the valedictorian of the Henry McNeil Turner High School, a top public school for African Americans in Atlanta. Charlene Hunter was also a top graduate. Both were active in school activities. Both were from respected families. Holmes' father was a businessman, while Hunter's father was an Army chaplain. Holmes' goal was to become a doctor like his grandfather. Hunter dreamed of a career in journalism. Their applications to the University of Georgia were rejected. Holmes entered Morehouse College, and Hunter headed to Wayne State University in Michigan. Meanwhile, they continued to apply every quarter, while the NAACP legal team, with the help of three Atlanta attorneys, took their case to court. In January 1961, U.S. District Court Judge William Boodle ordered that they be admitted to the University of Georgia, and both students registered for that winter quarter. The national media was there to cover the event as the two arrived on campus to a mostly hostile white student body. 2 days after their arrival, a riot broke out following a basketball game against in-state rival Georgia Tech. Athens police broke up the riot with tear gas. Holmes and Hunter were suspended from school and taken to Atlanta by the Georgia State Patrol. A few days later, the courts ordered UGA to readmit and protect them. Eventually, things settled down. Hunter Gault graduated from the Grady School of Journalism and has had a very successful career in print and broadcast journalism. Holmes graduated with honors from the university and became the first African-American admitted to Emory University School of Medicine. He became a well-known orthopedic surgeon in Atlanta and eventually medical director of Grady Hospital. Reviewing the section. 1. Define integration. 2. What was the Sibley Commission? 3. Why was the Brown versus Board of Education decision so important for Georgia? Page 613, Georgia Portraits, Charlene Hunter Gault. Born in the small town of Due West, South Carolina, Charlene Hunter spent most of her childhood years in Atlanta. Her father was a chaplain in the U.S. Army, and the family sometimes accompanied him to his various posts. In her first year of high school, the family moved to Alaska, where her father had been assigned. There, she was the only African American in a school of white classmates. She returned to Atlanta the next year to graduate third in her class at Henry McNeil Turner High School. A talented writer who had been on the school newspaper, her dream was to become a journalist. One of the best journalism schools was the University of Georgia, and she applied. The university turned her down, but she kept applying. Meanwhile, she attended Wayne State University and Integrated University in Michigan. In 1961, Federal Judge William Boodle ordered the University of Georgia to admit Charlene and Hamilton Holmes. Placed in a dorm room by herself, Charlene faced isolation. In her book, In My Place, Charlene Hunter Gault described falling asleep to the southern lullaby that the white students shouted, 2, 4, 6, 8, we don't want to integrate. On the third night in the dorm, a brick flew through her window and a riot began outside her dorm. She and Holmes were suspended. Under a judge's orders, she and Holmes returned to the school where she settled into the routine of a somewhat lonely college life. She graduated in 1963 with her journalism degree. By that time, she was already well known. Charlene Hunter Gault began working at the New Yorker magazine. She then became a news reporter and anchor for a television station in Washington, D.C. From 1968 to 1978, she worked for the New York Times. She left the print media for the broadcast media when she became a reporter for the PBS National Evening News Show. In 1997, her husband, banker Ronald Gault, was transferred to South Africa. She became an Africa correspondent for National Public Radio, NPR, and later for CNN. Her work earned her many awards, including an Emmy and 2 Peabody Awards. The Peabody Awards, given by the Grady College of Journalism, are the top awards for broadcast journalists. In spite of her difficult times at UGA, Hunter Gault became a supporter of the university. In 1988, she became the first African American to deliver the graduation address at UGA. The school named a lecture for Hunter Gault and Holmes. In 2001, UGA named the building where they had first registered the Hunter Holmes Academic Building. The two funded a scholarship for African Americans at the university.